Back in high school, I remember taking a biology class where one day we did a rudimentary experiment about how ecosystems work. We were given a bunch of data about a made-up environment. And in this environment, there were four primary species: oak trees, mice, squirrels, and foxes. Year one, the oak trees produced a bumper crop of acorns. Year two, well fed, the mouse and squirrel population took off, and that leveled off the acorns. In year three, the foxes were having a heyday eating the mice and squirrels, reducing their numbers. Eventually, the foxes ran out of surplus rodents to eat, so their numbers fell too. Well, I remember plotting out those four population curves. Back then, we did it by hand on that beautiful green graph paper. And I remember watching the curves rise and fall in a staggered pattern. Oaks, mice, squirrels, foxes. The lesson was clear. Environmental systems will not tolerate radical imbalance. They will self-correct, eventually. It is one of the simple and elegant laws of nature. Now, I'd barely given any thought to that high school lesson since then. That is, until late last year, when the United Nations announced that human beings had reached a major milestone. 8 billion people on planet Earth. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Human agriculture first emerged some 10,000 years ago, and there were as few as 1 million people to maybe about 15 million people. Estimates vary. It took 10,000 years, though. 10,000 years, all the way to approximately the year 1800, for the population to hit our first billion. It took a mere 222 years more for the human population to rise another 7 billion to our current 8 billion souls. Now, humanity keeps defying expectations. But how long can we defy what that high school lesson purportedly taught me? How long can we defy the laws of nature? Well, here's Dr. Rachel Snow of the United Nations Population Fund late last year when the UN announced human beings had reached 8 billion strong.
The world reaching 8 billion is not a catastrophe. In fact, it's a grand success globally. More people are surviving. Life expectancy has increased across the world. Healthcare has improved. And more people are thriving. It would be a catastrophe if governments can't prepare for what's coming in the next few decades.
Now, there's an interesting question. Are governments adequately preparing for a more populated world, an even more populated world? I should mention that demographers expect something of a slowdown in the rate of growth in the near future, but nevertheless, we're expected to reach 9 billion in the next 15 years. And much of that growth will happen in Africa. The continent's population is expected to double in the next 30 years. Well, Winnie Matula, a professor of development studies at the University of Nairobi in Kenya, says that to prepare for that future, Kenya needs to launch a massive effort to build 96,000 housing units per day now.
When I hear of 8 billion, I start reflecting on the increased population and its effect on our capacity, which is already struggling in terms of service provision and infrastructure. For example, housing, either within the central parts or on the suburbs. I envisage them to have more pressure in terms of carrying capacity, because if we cannot improve on inclusion and expanding economic opportunities, then we are likely to find many people not affording an average housing and an average living area, which has all the services that are required.
So today we want to look at a couple of things. One, are governments in places where the next billion humans are expected to be born ready for that? What would it take to help those countries get ready? And second, I'm still not quite yet done with that thought experiment about the carrying capacity of the ecosystem we call planet Earth when it comes to the human population curve. Well, joining me today is Jennifer Shuba. She is a fellow at the Wilson Center and a demographer and author of 8 Billion and Counting, How Sex, Death, and Migration Shape Our World. Jennifer, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. I'm excited to talk to you about my favorite subject.
So first of all, tell me, you saw obviously the 8 billion coming, being a demographer. But when human beings reached that milestone late last year, kind of tell me about your state of mind. What were your first thoughts?
Well, my first thought about hitting 8 billion was that I felt really different about it from when we hit 6 billion people. So when you were talking about when you were in high school and you kind of had this moment where you understood the relationship of people to the world around them. That moment for me was in 1999 when I was a sophomore in college and my very eccentric professor showed up in class one day and stopped at the doorway long enough for us to look at her. And she was wearing a black armband. And then she started marching in front of our desk saying that today world population has hit 6 billion people and this is an absolute travesty. She never had children, and we should never have children either.
Huh.
I realized that in my lifetime, and I don't like to think of myself as very old, I've already seen us hit 5 billion, 6 billion, 7 billion, and 8 billion. And if I take good care of myself, I think I'll see world population peak. So it tells me that we've got a lot of hubris as human beings. There are so many points in our human history where we've written about the sky falling, but the sky has stayed up there. And like the quote you used from the UN Population Fund, life has gotten better for the majority of people on the planet.
Yeah.
But, and I think the but is what we're going to unpack here over the next hour.
Well, I just want to say that we're not, and I completely agree with you, Jennifer, we're not going to rehash the population bomb debate.
Yep.
Because this is a much more nuanced question. And so for you, complete the ellipses you just left us with. But what?
But we have to be able to hold a couple of things true in our heads at once, which we're not great at doing because we like to simplify. If we imagine our global population growth and as 2 points and they're together and over a timeline, like everything is pretty similar around the world. The experiences are similar around the world. They really start to diverge last century. So you can imagine those 2 points coming apart. Right now, we are at a huge point of divergence. So for people like me, who's, you know, I'm cozily ensconced in a sound booth, nice and warm, have plenty of the effects of environmental change and population pressure on my resources. But as you mentioned, there are many places in the world where people rely on their immediate environment in order to survive, and they do feel those effects. So we have 2 very different experiences around the world, to keep it simple. On the one hand, there are a handful of countries that are experiencing rapid population growth, and those will drive global numbers over the next several decades. But on the other hand, 2 out of every 3 people on the planet live somewhere with below replacement fertility, meaning below the number needed just to keep the population growth steady.
Mm. Okay, so quickly tell us, what are the, I mentioned Africa, the continent of Africa, but are there specific countries within Africa or the continent that we should focus on as one of the places of population growth in the next half century?
Yes, we can really identify those places. Yeah. And certainly it's not the whole region of sub-Saharan Africa. I think actually the really interesting story is to look at how population trends even within a region that we've lumped together for some good reason in the past has started to diverge. So there are places like South Africa and Botswana that have quite low fertility. But we also know that sub-Saharan Africa has some of the highest fertility on the planet. So more than half of the projected increase of total global population between now and mid-century is just going to be in 8 countries. That includes some in sub-Saharan Africa. So Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, Nigeria, Tanzania, they are really driving global growth because their fertility rates are quite high still.
So wait, let me just repeat what you just said to be sure I heard you correctly. More than half of global population growth in the next how many years?
In the next to 2050, so okay.
In the next 3 decades is going to take place in only 8 countries.
It'll be concentrated in just 8 countries. So we're talking about, you know, how a lot of our global trends in economics and so on were driven by the behemoth of China, mm-hmm. because China's so huge. It's somewhat similar to that. So India is also on the list of 8, Pakistan, Philippines, Egypt. So these are countries that they have large populations. And so if you think about what you did in high school, when you were plotting that out, the way that populations double, the way that they grow, there depends in part on how large the cohort of childbearing women is. Mm-hmm. And so because fertility has been high in the past, we have some pretty large cohorts of childbearing women. So the important thing to note here, and this is where it's going to get a little complicated, is that fertility is not high in all of those 8 countries, but they'll keep growing because they have a lot of potential mothers.
Right. Right. There's sort of like a momentum within the numbers.
That's exactly the word. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. 8 countries. And by the way, India is very soon going to overtake China as the most populous country in the world, is it not?
That's right. Maybe even already has. And what's fascinating about India, you mentioned the population bomb earlier. I also don't want to rehash it, but it is the country that Paul Ehrlich visited that prompted him to write the population bomb. And it is a country that today has below replacement fertility.
Wow. I honestly, in our prep for this hour, that's not a fact that I ran into. It does?
Yes, it does. And is headed even lower. So we know from surveys. So right now, their fertility rate is about 2 children born per woman in their lifetime. And just so everyone knows, we typically say that for replacement level fertility is 2.1. We give that little 0.1 as a margin of error, as very detached way of saying, in case people don't make it to reproductive age. So India is already below that. And we know from surveys that desired fertility is about 1.74.
Desired fertility in India.
That's right. So given the right tools to act on those preferences, it's headed to a lower.
Well, we're just going to take a really quick break and come back and talk a lot more about the fact that humanity is 8 billion strong now. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and Jennifer Shuba is with us today. She's a demographer and author of 8 Billion and Counting, How Sex, Death, and Migration Shape Our World. Now, Jennifer, you've written something really interesting, that you look at how humanity got from 7 billion to 8 billion as different than how we hit those previous billion-dollar markers. What was different about the last billion people?
I think you hit the nail on the head earlier when you talked about momentum. So much of what we're experiencing in our current population growth, because we already are 8 billion and counting, we hit that mark and we slid right past it in the next couple of seconds. It's built in from the past. So if we just focus on that overall number, I think we miss the most interesting stories about human population. And right now, the most interesting one is that we're further apart than we've ever been in terms of our birth and death trends around the world. I mean, we have, at the same time that we were talking about many countries in sub-Saharan Africa still growing and having high fertility. Last year, 36 countries had shrinking populations because they had more deaths than they had births. And this is even after COVID, which we had even a higher bump during that time.
And so, therefore, I'm not quite sure I understand the significance of that.
Well, it gives us a much more complex view on things like, are there too many people, for example, which is part of what we're here to talk about today. So if we look at this 8 billion number and we say, oh, what a travesty. We went from 7 billion to 8 billion people. Like my professor had told me, that's way too many. We've identified the problem as too many people, which means the solution is we should have fewer. And the policy solution to that is family planning. But once we've peeled back and understood how we got from 7 to 8 billion, that a lot of it is embedded in the past, we see that family planning is not actually going to slow down population growth in the majority of places in the world. And so we now have to think about an entirely new policy set of solutions, which we've not been very imaginative about. I mean, I do remain surprised that our conversation at 8 billion looked a lot like it did at 1 billion people, which is when Malthus wrote his essay on the principles of population and said, there's too many people. Our conversation hasn't gotten much more nuanced, even though the population trends themselves have gotten a lot more nuanced.
Okay, I see what you're getting at now. So you're basically saying that that our conversation is still, there are too many people, the sort of apocalyptic view of human population growth versus sort of the techno-utopian view that we will always, will come up with technological or innovative ways to support ever higher numbers of people, conceivably not knowing if there's a cap to the human population.
I think it's even more than that. So in your experiment in high school, you were noticing that the environment self-regulates.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, what we need to notice is that human population has also self-regulated. We have already done it. There are so few places in the world where we still have really high fertility. And in fact, the opposite end of the spectrum is really the trend that will shape us from 8 to 9 billion people. That overall growth is still happening, but there are forces underneath it. So if you can imagine a cross-section of the planet and what you're looking at is more and more people piling on top, that seems to be all we're focusing on. What's underneath that, though, is that our rate of change has actually been falling since the 1960s. Total global fertility is getting really close to replacement level. It's at 2.3 children born per woman on average. So while there are these handful of countries that still have very high fertility and they will drive our growth from 8 to potentially 10 billion people, if we look at environmental issues as being too many people and we try to solve it through family planning, we've missed it. Because instead we need to look at how are we living, not how many of us are there. Family planning, frankly, isn't going to slow down population growth between now and 2050. Two-thirds of that is going to happen even if fertility were to come down to replacement level in the places where it's high immediately.
So
that means we got to redefine it to think about, what are we doing out here? How are we using our earth, and how are we producing? How are we consuming?
Yeah. So the question not being how many should there be, but how are we living right now? And then, as you said, it becomes an even sharper question because of the different experiences, right, that are going on right now in the places that will continue to have those high growth rates versus the ones that do not. I mean, I'm obviously sharing the experience with you, Jennifer. I'm in a super comfortable radio studio, living a super comfortable life in the global West here, versus what's happening now and will continue to happen. Again, I'm focusing on Africa because I don't think we talk a lot enough about how life is going to change for Africans over the next 30 years. So we actually spoke to several experts in Africa, and one of them is Andat Da Sogot, and he heads up the United Nations Population Fund Population and Development Unit in Abuja, in Nigeria. And as Nigeria's population grows, he's seeing greater and greater strains on existing infrastructure.
There are a lot of time wasted in traffic. It takes sometimes more than 2-3 hours to get to the city center from the suburbs. And it is actually worse in Lagos. So infrastructure is a big problem, not just in terms of traffic, but also in terms of power. With the population increase, power is reduced, and in most cities, power is rationed. It's also bad with education because the number of people in classrooms are growing by the day.
And he also says that he remembers as he was growing up as a young boy in Nigeria that the country was progressing and there was hope as Nigerians worked together to build prosperity.
When I was young, during holidays, when we come back on holidays, we were given these temporary jobs and sometimes we were involved in collecting revenue for the government. And when we remit those revenues to the government, those monies were used almost immediately to improve infrastructure around our communities. But today, it is no longer the case.
So, Jennifer, then give me your thoughts about the level of preparedness especially those several important African countries that are going to be the source of a lot of the growth, that they have for all the new African babies that are going to come along.
I'm so glad we're talking about this because in the effort to really make sure that we think this through, one of the things that gets left behind often is the variable of governance. And so I'm trained as a political scientist, but I use demographics to understand the world. And we know that there's no single demographic trend that's inherently good or bad. The same demographic trend can happen in two different places with two very different outcomes. And I think that's where we have to start looking at what's happening in many countries in Africa. So governance will make the difference. Let's compare Nigeria with Botswana, for example. Now, they're two very different countries in many ways. But if we go back to the 1960s, Botswana actually had higher fertility than Nigeria did. They were up around 7 children per woman on average. But starting in the 1970s, the government in Botswana really started to put an emphasis on making family planning freely available, a lot of emphasis on girls' education, and integrating over the decades reproductive health, family planning into general primary care, and girls' secondary and school enrollment is now higher than boys. As a result, if we look at the trend lines for fertility in Nigeria versus Botswana, Nigeria is still one of the 8 highest in the world at about 5 children per woman on average, while Botswana is now below 2.9. So we see that government investment in the population can make a huge difference. And of course, there's lots of examples of this around the world where two places have the same trend, but they really start to diverge. And so we do need to have, there's a lot of advocacy organizations that try to get governments around the world with high fertility to think about the benefits of education and healthcare and how those yield general societal dividends at the same time that they also can help a country accomplish its population goals. But it takes decades to see those work. So we know that Nigeria is going to add a lot more people over the next few decades. But governance can make a difference in whether or not those become an asset or a liability for the government.
Okay, so we also spoke with someone in Kenya. We heard a little bit from her earlier, Winnie Matula, professor of development studies at the University of Nairobi in Kenya. And she has seen the population of Nairobi mushroom since she was a child.
I'm born and raised in Nairobi, so I've had all my life in Nairobi. I remember as a young person, you know, areas that I saw almost no built environment. It was just where we could go and walk, and you'd even be scared because it was really like a suburb. Those are now built up and quite different, you know.
And we also asked her whether rural Kenyans, obviously she lives in Nairobi, but what are the impacts that rural Kenyans are noticing given the population growth in Kenya and also worldwide climate change?
It's glaring. You know, some years back, I guess when my parents lived, if you needed firewood, you just walked behind your house or close by and you were able to gather some trees and, you know, cook. You could use them as energy. Today, there is just nowhere to get that energy. People can give you accounts of rivers that used to flow endlessly and are no longer flowing. Like in recent times, Kenya's lost thousands of animals because of drought. Of course, then one has to come and try to relate it to rural people that this is part of climate change. Actually, sometimes we say you cannot use the word climate change in local language, but the change is there. People know there is change on weather, change on climate.
That's Winnie Matula, a professor of development studies at the University of Nairobi in Kenya. Well, Jennifer, I want to bring another voice into the conversation. William Reese joins us now. He's a professor emeritus of ecological economics and human ecology at the University of British Columbia. Professor Reese, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you very much.
So, you know, Jennifer said something very, very interesting before, that when it comes to understanding the impact or how to think through the meaning of our still sort of almost vertical population growth curve, that we've been locked in a way of thinking for some 200 years. And that's missing the truth of how to, you know, to think about human population today. And is part of what we've been locked into is the presumption that the only way to measure the quality of life for every additional billion human beings is through our measures of economic growth, Professor Rees.
Yeah, I think you've put your finger on something extremely important. Let's look at that past 200 years, because it's really a unique period in human history. You've already mentioned it took us about 250,000 years to reach our first billion people in the early 1800s. And then in just 200 years, a tiny fraction of that amount of time, we expanded by eightfold. And so we've seen about 10 generations of people who've experienced both population and economic growth. And yet we take that to be the norm. And I really think we have to begin to see this past 200 years as the most abnormal or anomalous period in human history. And it's really the result of our extensive use of fossil fuel. Because in the early 1800s, we began to use coal and then gas and oil to the extent that it enabled us for the first time ever to acquire all of the food and other resources needed to grow the human enterprise. Meanwhile, public health was improving, so survival rates increased dramatically without much effect on birth rates. So we had a unique set of circumstances converging, whereby for the first time in human history, our population was freed from all of the negative feedback holding it in check. And so we expanded virtually explosively as a result of a temporary period of abundance, particularly abundance of energy, which enabled us to acquire all of these other resources. So this is a unique period, and we really have to question whether it's possible even to maintain the current population as our energy problems begin to emerge. We've already heard some reference to that.
Yeah. Well, so actually, can I just turn to Jennifer here really quickly, because I'd really love to hear what you think about this, Jennifer. When Professor Rees says we've been experiencing over the past couple of centuries an anomalous period in human history where both population and economic growth have been happening at the same time. That's actually shaped not only our view of economics, it's shaped our politics as well. I mean, I know in the past several years, let's take Japan for an example. I keep reading these screaming headlines about like the low fertility rate in Japan, the rapidly aging population in Japan means like economic doom for the nation of Japan. I mean, is that true, Jennifer?
So William and I, we're of one mind with this because it's that economic growth variable we have to focus on. So because we as a especially our governments have put that as our highest value, everything is discussed in relation to that. So what we have to think about with population is now there is hand-wringing. I talked about that divergence earlier. Mm-hmm. So if we're going to set aside for now those few countries that are still growing and focus on that two-thirds that has below replacement fertility, there is extreme hand-wringing over there being too few people, because we have gotten to this point where we have seen that population is the foundation of our economy. And therefore, if there are, quote unquote, too few people, then we cannot sustain the economic growth that we have come to place as our highest value. And so what I think is really important about this conversation we're having today is it gives us the opportunity to question that value of economic growth, or let's say that model as it has been, the status quo model of economic growth. We know that the whole world is headed towards aging and shrinking. We have self-regulated. And so how will we continue to have vibrant and healthy societies absent seeing economic growth as the thing to which we should aspire to? And on Japan, let's make a note about this really quickly. So I'm not a doomsayer about population aging at all. same reason that I said that the same population trend in two different countries can have really different outcomes. And we talked about with sub-Saharan Africa, same thing for aging. So aging doesn't look the same around the world. Given what we initially thought about population aging, Japan should be a country we no longer even mention. And yet it remains one of the world's strongest economies. So we should really look to Japan to say, what are the kinds of things that they're doing right? Because they are the vanguard, but they are not alone.
Well, Jennifer Shuba and William Reese, stand by. We'll have a lot more when we come back. I'm going to want to explore with both of you sort of what would be a new framework, a new mindset to think about the relationship between population and economic growth that might help us as we, you know, continue into the next 30, 40, 50 years in human history. So that's what we'll talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today we're talking about how to think about the meaning and the future of humanity's population on planet Earth, because late last year we hit 8 billion strong. And as our guest Jennifer Shuba says today, we cruised right past that number in November of 2022. And Jennifer is a fellow at the Wilson Center and author of 8 Billion and Counting, How Sex, Death, and Migration Shape Our World. We're also joined by William Reese. He's a professor emeritus of ecological economics and human ecology at the University of British Columbia. And Professor Reese and Jennifer, I wonder if you could just listen along with me for a couple of minutes here, because you know, when we talk about human population on planet Earth, we can get kind of myopic, right, about thinking about, well, what about the quality of life for human beings and economic growth for human beings and things like that. But of course, we are not the only species on planet Earth. I mean, I would argue that no matter what our numbers are, for as long as they keep growing, there is an inescapable impact on the other species on this planet. So for a view about how human population growth has had an impact on the plant and animal kingdoms, we turn to Elizabeth Hadley. She's a biologist at Stanford University and director of the Jasper Ridge Biological Preserve in California's Santa Cruz Mountains. And for four decades, she's been an eyewitness to the astounding changes she's seen in the plant and animal kingdoms.
Remember all those insects you used to have on your windshield when you drove across the West? Gosh, they're not there anymore. Why? So I did a lot of work in Yellowstone, driving back and forth from either here or Berkeley, wherever I was living at the time. And sometimes I would have to stop more frequently to clean my windshield than I did to fill up with gas. And no more. I can drive across the country, which I just did, by the way, and not clean my windshield. And that's horrifying to me. So in my 40-some years of doing this, I have seen fewer large game animals like rhinos, like grizzly bears, like bighorn sheep, like whales. I have seen fewer fish in the sea, and the fish that I have caught, I like to fly fish, the fish that I have personally handled in some of these amazing streams in the American West are smaller and harder to find. Why do we have a loss of almost 70% of the wild animal populations in the world? Why is this happening? And the bottom line is that there are so many people and we are consuming so much of the biomass of the planet. We're kind of harboring it for ourselves and for our domesticated animals. I learned this from a farmer. If you look at a ranch where there's a lot of cow patties, you know they're drugging their animals big time. And those cow patties are going to stay there for a long time because they're basically sterilizing their soil. If you look at another ranch where they're not applying so many of those pesticides, there's not as many cow patties. And it's because the dung beetles and the worms and everything that kind of helps decompose is working at it. So even if you don't care about the ethical considerations of eliminating species on the tree of life, it's important to realize that we're actually doing the culling. The Great Acceleration is a compilation of data that shows it's not just the increase in human population size, but it's the increase in our consumption. And it's not just per capita consumption that stays the same. And so therefore you just add more people and you increase consumption that way. We're actually consuming more than we used to. So there's only so much solar radiation that reaches the Earth. And that solar radiation for millions of years is the only thing that's kind of governed biomass. And now, of course, you know, we're getting old solar energy from fossil fuels and we're adding to that. And what we're doing is we are now replacing all wild biomass with the biomass we choose. And the problem is that's not sustainable. And there are all sorts of ways that it could unravel, but the one I'm the most concerned about is that as we lose biomass, as we lose biodiversity, the biomass of diversity, we're losing our potential solutions. And if we're losing populations of species the way all of the data suggests, more than 60% of them in the last few decades, then what that means is it's a direct affront to our own survival. They are the canary in the coal mine, and we're living in the coal mine too.
That's Elizabeth Hadley, a professor of biology at Stanford University and director of the Jasper Ridge Biological Preserve. Professor William Reese, respond to what Professor Hadley said there. What do you make of her analysis of we're living in the coal mine too?
Well, she's absolutely correct. I think people tend to forget that the Earth hasn't gotten any larger. And as she mentioned, there's a fixed amount of solar radiation that is fixed by green plants, and that is used to support all animal life. So that in just 10,000 years, human beings have gone from being much fewer than 1% of mammalian biomass to the point that we are now 34%. And if you add our domestic animals, that's another 60-odd%. So together, humans plus our domestic animals amount to about 96 or 97% of the total biomass of mammals on planet Earth. So we're witness to and the cause of a phenomenon that ecologists would call competitive displacement. Since there's a limited amount of energy and material in the system, the more humans get, the less there is for other species. So the growth of the human enterprise is literally pushing the rest of advanced life off the planet. And that's the phenomenon that she was describing. We're seeing an absolute collapse in insect populations in many places, all the way up to advanced mammals. So this is a major crisis. And I think it's really important to understand that when we talk about population and we talk about, say, climate change, we tend as humans to think in very simplistic, reductionist terms, one problem at a time. But all of these things are connected in a phenomenon that I call overshoot. The human population and the human enterprise have simply overshot the long-term carrying capacity, even for human beings, of planet Earth. It's not a question of having to slow down our population and economic growth in the future. We need to begin to think of this right now, because the current population at current average levels of consumption is not sustainable. Because we are currently living by depleting the natural capital upon which we all depend. We're depleting the biomass. We're depleting biodiversity. We're destroying our soils. We're overfishing the seas. Everything that we depend on is being reduced by the continued growth of the economy and population.
Yeah.
And I think, again, it's very important to keep these things together. Population may have increased by eightfold in the last couple of hundred years, but the economy in real terms has grown by over a hundredfold. So that the consumption by humans has massively increased beyond the rate of a human population. So we now have to begin seriously to think of a phenomenon which is actually becoming very well known in Europe called degrowth, the planned contraction of the human enterprise, particularly of consumption by the wealthy, so that we can accommodate to the biocapacity of planet Earth.
Yeah.
Population is an enormous problem. Consumption is an enormous problem. But population growth stimulates consumption. Mm.
Well, let me pull Jennifer back in here. So Jennifer, I think, you've previously talked about understanding population dynamics in terms of levers. So when I'm seeing some clear levers come out here. Obviously, there's just the sheer numbers of people. There's this idea of economic growth being the only way to measure human advancement. And then there's consumption. So maybe, because you've asked the question, can we stop thinking? Can we, as human beings, stop thinking about slower population growth rates as equating to like the end of economic growth? And I would say maybe one way of doing that. Oh, let me ask you, is one way of doing that worrying less about the next billion people and more, as Professor Reese is saying, about who's doing the majority of the consumption now?
Yeah, and in contrast to maybe what William said, I would really try to take the population piece out of it or look at it in a different way, because it is those countries that are actually experiencing shrinking populations already, which, by the way, if you're a listener to this program, you might live in one. This is a global program, and we know that all across Western Europe, East Asia, and, births over deaths in many places in North America, it's not a thing anymore. There's more deaths than births. So, yes, U.S. population is still growing, large part from immigration. For your listeners
but
to know.
If
we're
I can
moving
interject.
Towards this aging and shrinking world.
Can I just let Jennifer
so
finish?
We have,
go ahead.
Yeah, we're moving toward this aging and shrinking world. And we are worried because we can't sustain that same huge level of economic growth in the past. And we do need to think about what that might look like. So we can relook at concepts like retirement. We can look at concepts like what is work life. We also, though, have to start thinking about family and marriage. And, we're talking about a paradigmatic shift. That means we have to look at the world through a completely different lens than we've looked at the world in the past. But all of our theories about the good life, our economic theories, our political theories, those were all developed under conditions of population growth and economic growth, as William said. So it's really hard to get a paradigmatic shift and say, what if we try to look at the world in a different way? Can we look at an aging and shrinking society as a good thing? Can we look at growing older individually as a good thing? We've not been good at that. And so we're kind of taking that negativity and applying it at the societal level.
Mm. Professor Reese, I'll give you a minute to respond, but we're rapidly running out of time here. But go ahead.
Yeah, I think some of that's very important. We have to keep in mind, though, that although fertility rates are falling in some Western countries, if you take Canada and the United States, the populations continue to grow at 1% or so per year. And the addition of every wealthy person to the country is to the population is the equivalent of, say, 15 or 20 people in one of the poorer countries. So when we hear of the decline of a population such as Japan's, that's cause for celebration. It's not cause for despair because of the economic implications of that. Those are minor problems compared to the problems of overshoot, which you're confronting right now. The world is in a state of overshoot. We are depleting and polluting the very biophysical basis of our own existence. It is consumption of resources that does that, but both population and income growth are important contributors to that consumption. And right now, we can show that even though we diminish population in this conversation, it is the driving factor in much of the world. Countries that are experiencing very rapid population growth, as some of your earlier speakers showed, are just benefiting from that. No one gains because the benefits of economic growth are overwhelmed by the increase in populations. And even in rich countries, as I say, the major contribution right now at the margin to environmental impact by those people is from population growth, not income growth, because the average per capita ecological footprints of people has stabilized even in wealthy countries. So yes, it's consumption, but there are two components, income growth and population growth. The world is in overshoot right now. We have to think of reducing both populations and gross economic consumption.
Yeah. Well, Professor Rees, if I might say, we're not de-emphasizing the importance of population growth here. I mean, it's the whole ethos of the entire hour is what's why we're talking about it. And, you know, Jennifer made the point earlier that even, you know, if because of the demographics of the countries that are experiencing a lot of growth now, as we mentioned, there's just a momentum factor involved that's going to continue raising numbers. So I just want to like acknowledge both of those things. But we're getting to the place where I think it's a really good way to sort of help people rethink things. And so, Jennifer, I want to turn to you on this because, look, tomorrow on our show, we're going to be doing a program about essentially fast fashion, right? And how like we're living in a world where people wear shirts for 4 days and then throw them away. So it seems like you're saying, hey, look, what we really need to do, in fact, both of you are saying, is that one of the things we have to think about maybe is, you know, less about the fact that there's going to be 100 million new Bangladeshis in the next 5 years. I'm just making up that number, but I presume it's a place where population is growing. And more about the fact that we're asking those Bangladeshis to make millions and millions of shirts that we here in the West will only wear for a few days. And that thinking about those things about us as consumers, which we do, we don't often think of ourselves as citizens much anymore, is really part of the problem that we actually can address right now.
Yeah, I think the population problem is mostly taken care of, quote unquote. Fertility is down, it is falling. And what's not taken care of is how we live and how we consume. And frankly, it is much easier to implement a family planning program and give some girls some education and say, ah, I did it, I did the work, than it is to say, I, as an individual, am going to change the way I spend my money, the way I live my life, the way I cook my dinner at night. And so it's actually pretty convenient for us to keep this population bomb theory alive because it excuses our inaction. But unless we start focusing on the way that the 2/3 of the people who have low fertility in this world live, then we're not going to get any closer to solving our environmental devastation.
Can that be done? I mean, you're coming from the point of view of the social science and political science. We are very much still enraptured with that economic growth model of human success.
Yeah, right now, no, it can't be done. Because you can have the same government leader say, what a travesty that we have overshoot. What a travesty that we are consuming so much. So let me give you some billions of dollars to help this endangered species. And also, I want to make sure that we are seeing more jobs and more consumption. And I'm following those indices because that is how I define my success. And if I don't do it that way, I get voted out.
Well, Jennifer Shuba, author of 8 Billion and Counting, How Sex, Death, and Migration Shape Our World. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jennifer.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
And William Rees, Professor Emeritus of Ecological Economics and Human Ecology at the University of British Columbia. Professor Rees, thank you so much for joining us and especially bringing to the table that concept of overshoot.
Thank you.
Yeah, really appreciate it. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.